Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Anyone who drives a car at some point is pushed to the side by a siren-blaring ambulance speeding down the street to the nearest hospital. Some of our listeners may have ridden inside of an ambulance. We all know from TV and movies that paramedics are daily heroes, able to restart fibrillating hearts, administer medication, and resuscitate people who aren't breathing. But what was it like in the early days, before we had so much medical technology and know-how to keep people alive, as we say, in the field, that is, before they arrive at the hospital? Well, my guest today, Mike Scardino, is the author of a new memoir titled Bad Call, A Summer Job on a New York Ambulance. Without any training, Scardino was nudged into the job by his father, at whose Queens gas station the ambulances often filled their tanks. Scardino had thoughts of applying to medical school, but after his first summer on the job, it's no surprise that he wound up in a career in advertising. A caution to listeners, some of the ambulance calls detailed in today's interview might be upsetting. Mike Scardino, author of the new memoir Bad Call, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Mike Scardino, welcome to Medical Monday. Congratulations on your new book, Bad Call. And I just start by, if you can, what was Queens like, the borough of Queens in 1967 to 1970 when you were working on an ambulance in your summers and vacations?
Queens, you know, New York is funny, all over New York. It's kind of always the same and always changing. It was funny, I found some of the old pictures I had taken from that era and saw how low down it was. It wasn't very built up. You know, it's much higher now, I guess. But I was born near where I worked, and it's kind of, you know, it's utilitarian. I guess that's the best thing I could say for it. You know, it's kind of, it's not really a beautiful place. I always wanted to live out in the country and get away from the pavement and everything else. And we lived in Bayside, moved from Elmhurst to Bayside, which is just about almost the eastern edge of Queens. And when we moved out there in 1954, that was like the countryside. So coming back to work on an ambulance in the late 60s was kind of like going back to a place I really didn't want to be. And it was compounded by the fact that I was kind of on the street working in a very down and dirty kind of a job. So, yeah, you know, Queens was, it was rough and tough. And you know, we were, you know, kind of a little, all of us a little street kid in us, I think. My mother was from the South. She was from Nashville. So I had kind of a funny upbringing, half Southern Baptist, half Italian Yankee Catholic, and you could imagine the some of the fun conversations that we had.
Well, I bet it probably helped you in terms of, at least in the book, in terms of relating to the clientele you served. I mean, the diverse population, which was diverse then and is, you know, even more diverse now. I mean, Queens is, I think, one of the most diverse places in the whole country.
Absolutely. If you had to say, you had to point to a place and say, where's the melting pot? I'd say, well, it's still there. My father's family, he was a first generation Italian, living in a predominantly German neighborhood, and yeah, it was very diverse, and it was a good place to be, I think, to see people of all walks of life, especially of all economic levels, and it really taught you not to be judgmental, I think.
So you worked for an outfit called, was it St. John's Ambulance, or?
Right, it was St. John's Queens Hospital, and at the time, New York City, I guess it was a hospital corporation, was hiring out hospitals that weren't city hospitals to answer 911 calls. So basically, we answered all the calls that any other city hospital would answer. So there were several non-city hospitals, Mary Immaculate. A lot of them were Catholic hospitals, as this one was. And then there was all the city hospitals. There were Elmhurst General and Booth Memorial, Flushing Hospital, Queens General, et cetera. All of the city hospitals. A lot of them are gone now, and it's created quite a crisis in terms of emergency care.
Like in a lot of places, I'm thinking of more rural areas where rural, smaller hospitals have struggled. I mean, so you're talking about consolidation or just smaller neighborhood hospitals not being able to keep up with the sort of the medical technology arms race or things like that. So there's been, people are often referred to these bigger tertiary centers and things in Queens, and then I suppose even in Manhattan or other boroughs.
Yeah, but, you know, a lot of the bigger hospitals folded. St. John's was a good-sized hospital, and so was Mary Immaculate. Almost all the Catholic hospitals closed. They just couldn't afford to operate, you know, and they couldn't afford to update. So they were good-sized places. And, of course, this reduced the number of emergency rooms, the number of ambulances. I understand. I've been keeping up. I read some of these Queens journals, blogs and stuff that come out of there, and everyone's pretty much up in arms about the waiting time and the lack of services. They just can't get an ambulance. And
wow.
The ambulance is fundamentally different now, as you know, being a physician, than it was then. I mean, we had very little training. We had no meds, no telemetrics or anything like that. We had a two-way radio. We couldn't even call the hospital when we were out on a call. We could only talk to central dispatch. They had to call the hospital. Hospital had to tell them yes, no, whatever, and then they would radio us back and tell us what the response was. If you look at some of the pictures of the interior of the ambulance, I think it's pretty shocking compared to the way ambulances look today. We had an aluminum stretcher, two bottles of dry oxygen. The rest of the equipment were splints, Curlix, bandages, you know, backboards, things like that. We had a maternity bag. But, you know, today they can really help people. And that, you know, I've actually been debating this with a couple of people since I wrote the book. And I'm wondering, you know, our emphasis was on speed. I've got letters that I wrote to my wife when we were in college, when I was working on the ambulance, where we would have four extremely critical calls in 1 hour. And then I know now when they go on a call, they could actually treat the person at the scene, but that may go on for 20 minutes, 25 minutes before they move the patient. So I'm wondering if, I'm kind of wondering which is the better system, you know, to be able to take somebody right away and get them back to a hospital, or to take the time to treat them at the scene and maybe not be able to go on other calls. So it'd be interesting to see what the statistics are on that, but I don't personally know.
Well, and you also talk about the ambulance being a manual transmission, which is harder to picture now. And there's this one scene where it's wintertime. So you start out as a summer, and I should say underage, right, when you started right. doing this. So I guess tell us, why did you work on the ambulance? What were you looking for?
I wasn't looking to work on the ambulance. My mother, being from Nashville, she really was pressing me a lot to go to Vanderbilt. She wanted me to go there. I was willing to go to Queens College, which is a city college in New York. And tuition was virtually nothing. And when I started at Vanderbilt, you may not believe this, but the tuition was $900 a year.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And they thought, well, you know, it won't be too bad. My father had the gas, and he had a gas station. He had the gasoline and repair account for St. John's Hospital. So he kind of negotiated with the boss at St. John's Hospital to put me on. And it was a very lucrative job. It was 56 hours a week, 40 hours straight time and 16 time and a half. And it was considered a plum job by ambulance standards in the city at that time. And then it was presented to me as a fait accompli. You're going to go to work on an ambulance. And, you know, I'm a good Italian boy, or half Italian anyway. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. But I really didn't want to do it. I had been working since I was 13 in his gas station, both mostly all Saturdays and holidays and stuff, and I kind of was looking forward to doing some fun things in the summer. But kind of an indentured servitude situation, if you will, and I really was not looking forward to it. And I had heard a lot of the stories from the other guys when they came in to get gas at my father's station, and I was apprehensive of it, I have to be honest.
So what kind of training did they actually give you?
They didn't give me any.
I had
been a Boy Scout. I was an Eagle Scout, and I took first aid merit badge. And at that time, first aid merit badge was roughly the equivalent of the Red Cross Advanced First Aid course. So I knew, you know, a good amount of theoretical knowledge I had, but not really any practical experience. And they always would put me with an older guy who had a lot of experience and would kind of learn on the job. But there wasn't a lot that we could actually do. And at the bottom line, we couldn't. I don't think I ever gave CPR to anybody. I gave it to a patient once in the emergency room who had an aneurysm, and we were trying to keep his heart beating while they could get him up to the operating room, but it didn't keep him alive. But other than that, you know, we could stop bleeding to the extent that it would be stoppable. But mainly, we transported people as efficiently as we could without causing any further damage. And again, the emphasis was on speed to get them back as soon as possible.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Mike Scardino, who's author of the new memoir. Its name is Bad Call, A Summer Job on a New York Ambulance. This was back in the late 60s and early 70s when Mike was starting out college and did this as a summer job. And you were actually able to pay for your college education with this work. And, I mean, even one summer, as you pointed out, is a good job, good paying job, plum job that you didn't necessarily want. One thing that I was interested in is you thought or had thoughts of becoming a medical doctor. And you sort of reveal that all your ambulance time pretty much dissuaded you from that almost from the get-go.
It did. And I became very, obviously, you know, expectedly, I became very depressed working on the ambulance, seeing all of the misery and suffering and death, a lot of death. I realized early on that most of what I was seeing really have very little to do with the practice of medicine. I mean, when you get called to a DOA and somebody's under a cardboard box in a vacant lot, that's not medicine. And also realize that I think that ER personnel and in general are working in a controlled environment, and the patients come to them, and they, you know, the main variable is the patient. They don't have to deal with seeing how people live and going into people's lives at the worst possible time and dealing with all the grief. I mean, you can imagine, even, you know, of course there are spectacular, memorable calls that are horrible, but then just normal life and death, every day people die, and you're always with the families, and they're always grief-stricken. And after a while, it begins to wear you down a little bit. And I began to kind of get unfocused in terms of academia. I wasn't a good student anyway, especially where calculus and organic chemistry were concerned. And when I would go back to school after the first year, it was just such a relief not to have to go to work on the ambulance that all I wanted to do was play. And that's not a good strategy for staying in college.
Staying in college or certainly going to med school the way it is with the grades you got to make. So there's this chapter where you say, to all a good night. What happened on that Christmas, whichever was at 69 or something? Because you started as a summer ambulance helper, but you quickly realized, or they, the St. John outfit quickly realized that you were a valuable guy because you could do fill-in, and that the sort of the grown-ups on the crew and the drivers, and I'll get to that in a second, they, you know, they often wanted to spend some holidays with their families. So when you were home during the breaks from school, they asked you to pick up hours. And so you, one Christmas, at least, you worked where you saw something kind of, was it on the Grand Central Parkway?
Grand Central Parkway in a snowstorm. A lot of pedestrians used to cross the Grand Central Parkway at that particular point from a place called Astoria over to LaGuardia Airport.
I should just point out, it's like a major highway, basically, but they call it a parkway.
A parkway, yeah. And a highway. And I guess it's like 8 lanes across, and there's a big median. And I mean, it's a dangerous thing to do on the best of nights. And this was a snowstorm. The visibility was terrible. And we were just kind of settling in. It was Christmas Day and the evening of Christmas Day, and it was starting to snow and pretty heavy. We were all just, you know, thinking, okay, it's pretty quiet out there. And then we got a call, possible DOA crossing the Grand Central. And I'm thinking, of all the times, you know, I mean, it's a crazy thing to do anyway, but in a snowstorm on Christmas Day evening, it's just insane. So we went, and we saw the man, and he was dead, and he had been struck by an off-duty police officer. And my feeling was the police officer must have been called to quite a few fatal traffic accidents, but it's different when the shoe is on the other foot and you're involved in it. And he was extremely upset. And, of course, there was a man who was dead, and I knew his family would be upset. So I began to think, well, you know, I feel pretty guilty about myself for having to work in a gas station till 8, and look what's happened to them, and they're going to remember this every Christmas for the rest of their lives, or their families will. So it was kind of a sobering experience.
Yeah, that chapter really, really stuck with me. I also want to focus for a minute on your partners. You have a number of characters in the book with whom you work, and they were essentially the drivers of the ambulance, and you had some, there were just some real characters. I mean, for one thing, I guess talking still about winter, there you mentioned a scene where around LaGuardia and the highways. Oh, and I should just point out, you've mentioned DOA. That's dead on arrival, right?
Yeah.
Is that okay? I just want to, in case our listeners are wondering. There was an ice storm, essentially, or something. And so there were something like 50 car accidents on one cloverleaf. They were hitting guardrails or getting stuck. And what was interesting was, A, fortunately, I think nobody was really hurt. That was miraculous. But secondarily, you're driving this clunky, not you, but your partner driving this clunky ambulance around that's a stick shift on these icy roads. These drivers must be incredible. As you point out, you're trying to make a number of these calls an hour, these pickups. And then in these conditions, I mean, so was it just the sheer amount of practice these guys had at driving high speeds and things like that?
Well, it was a tremendous amount of driving. I mean, we were on the road all day sometimes, and we would there were days when we very rarely got back to the hospital. We'd have a radio call one after the other backed up, and we'd be out all day. But they were amazing. I mean, these were old, for the most part, they were old Chevy Suburbans of that era, and they had manual steering, no air conditioning, stick shift, just enormous beast to move around. I mean, they were horrible to drive, and they didn't really, very few of the guys drove really fast. That was kind of a rule. We did have to obey all the traffic rules, and they were pretty good about that. But a couple of them were insane. But I just never figured out how they drove so well. I mean, you're probably a lot younger than I am, but I mean, growing up in the North and driving cars with rear-wheel drive in the snow, it was kind of just a thing you did. You didn't think too much about it. And now people have, a lot of people have all-wheel drive and positive traction and anti-lock brakes, you know, and everything. It's pretty hard to put a foot wrong in a vehicle like that. And we had these old top-heavy, skinny-tired Suburbans, and it was impressive. I couldn't see how they did it. And all day long, you could imagine muscling around a vehicle like that in the streets of New York with the traffic and everything. It just was awful.
There was another scene right around there where you've mentioned DOA a couple of times, dead on arrival. So you had a number of these calls where essentially your job was to, you know, find someone and verify, in fact, or often I think law enforcement was there to verify they were dead, but you would have to transport them. And so one time, well, I'll let you tell the story, but the person wasn't actually dead.
Yeah, that was the man who had shot himself through the head at dinner time, and his family was in the next room. He had a family of adult children, men and women, and he'd been depressed, they said, about some conditions that he had, and went in while they were eating, and he shot himself through the head. And we got up there, and it was very, very difficult. It was a three-story private home, and the climb was extremely difficult. The stairways were, I'm sure they weren't to code, whatever that is, and we realized, well, I don't want to say it's a good thing that this man is a DOA. Usually when there was a DOA in a private home, we did not remove it. They would call a funeral home. We only removed it in a public place, unless there was a crime involved. So we got upstairs, and he was on the floor, and there was a massive amount of blood around his head, and he had a pistol in his hand. And got up, took a closer look, and there was a bullet hole on each side of his head. And, you know, I don't know what possessed us. We were all just kind of gawking at the man and looking at him, and no one thought that he wasn't dead. You can imagine. Most of his blood was on the floor, bullet hole on each side of his head, 83 years old, and he's, you know, this man is dead. So while we're standing there, one of the policemen takes the gun out of his hand, and he grunts and he jerks. He makes a spasmodic motion, and we all jumped, and then we realized we got to take him, and then we raced down my partner Jose and I raced down the stairs, and we realized, oh, no, we can't get our aluminum stretcher up here. So he knew, and I didn't at that point, that there was a canvas stretcher and poles in the bench inside the back of the ambulance, which we had to dig out, dig all the other materials out, straight jackets, everything, put that together, take that up with three straps to strap them on, because we were going to have to take him down vertically to remove him. And we did all that, got him to the hospital. The doctor took one look at him and listened to our story about what the circumstances were, and then he said, okay, put him over there. We had him on a gurney at that point, and I was a little bit surprised, but I was half surprised and half not surprised, because I knew there was nothing that could be done for this man, I mean, for all practical purposes. And yet I thought maybe we would have, you know, gone through the motions a little bit.
Yeah. And that young doctor, you describe how he's basically eating pizza and doesn't even put it down and sort of points with his slice of pizza and says, oh, yeah, put him over there. Just, and you're thinking, you're too young to be this callous.
Yeah, it was kind of a shock. But it was, as I say, it was a shock. And then again, it wasn't a shock, because you see so much. I was just put off a little bit, surprised a little bit by his bluntness.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Mike Scardino, author of the new memoir, Bad Call, A Summer Job in a New York Ambulance, where some 50 years ago, Mike spent his summers and also his holiday vacations working on an ambulance in Queens, New York. And at the end of your time working for St. John, there's this powerful and sad chapter where you have this, I didn't realize, or I guess I forgot, you're an Eagle Scout. And so you have one of your colleagues has given you this fantastic ambulance jacket with patches on it and everything. And Pete, who I guess is the, and that's probably not his real name,
That
is his real name. Okay. Well, so he, you come in to kind of say goodbye, and unfortunately none of your friends are around. And yeah. I guess tell us what happens with the jacket.
Well, it was a very, very cold day, and I had walked down from my father's gas station, which was about 4 or 5 blocks away, and really cold, bitterly, you know, the wind was blowing, and kind of like out of Dickens or something, I don't know, but I walked in, and as I said, nobody that I really wanted to see was there. I expected I would go there and say, so long, guys. It's been great. And Pete was there, and he didn't even look up when I walked in. He was just kind of like going about his business, and he looked up at me, and he didn't even say hello. He said, okay, he said, give me the jacket, kid. And this is after 4 years of working on the ambulance, and I was surprised, and I was offended, and I was hurt, too, because I thought, well, there's got to be more to that than this after all this time. And I explained to him that one of my coworkers was nice enough to have given it to me one time when I worked over Christmas and I didn't have a coat, an official coat. And so he said, no, I need it for the new guy. And I was so angry that I, for a brief moment, I wanted to hit him. That's how angry I was. And the thought of, you know, I even told him, I said, if you want to get the coat, I'll leave it with my father. When you go in for gas, pick it up. I said, I'll give it to him, I'll go home. No, I need it right now. Give it to me. So it was more, it was an outrage to think of somebody taking the coat off of anybody's back on a day like that when it wasn't necessary, and much less somebody who had worked very hard to try and do a good job. And so, you know, it was not a happy ending. And I took the coat off and I threw the coat at him. I didn't assault him or anything, but that just made him go ballistic. And he threatened me, and he said he was going to make sure that I never worked at St. John's again. And at that point, it was fine with me. I was going off to the Army. I didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah, you couldn't have been happier, right. But I was curious about that, too, because you were on your way to Fort Jackson to join the National Guard, was it? Now, were you drafted, or was this, you had managed to keep the job and stay in school having a student deferment, correct?
Yes, I had a student deferment, and like a lot of my friends, I mean, we all figured, all of us were against the war, but we all figured, I mean, even in high school, we thought, well, this is going to be over at some point in time, and it just never seemed to be over. And so I took my draft physical when I was still in college in Nashville, and I was 1A, and I thought, well, I better think about doing something about this. So I graduated in May of 70 and didn't seem to have any prospects. It was very funny. I called up the local Army Reserve unit, and they said they would only speak to people between 8 and 8:30 a.m. Mondays and Fridays. So I got that. I got the point.
Sounds like the cable company.
Yeah, exactly, like the cable. And so it so happened that the year before in New York, there was a postal strike, and the National Guard had been federalized, and all the participants got a year off their six-year obligation. So a neighbor just by chance told my mother, oh, you know, there might be openings in the National Guard. So I went down to Flushing, New York, which is not far from where I lived, and went to an orientation, and I really didn't want to do anything. I thought I was fine, and I was dead set against the war. I didn't want to, you know, it was a very complicated time. I had
sure.
friends that were in the SDS, and then I had friends that were like, couldn't wait to go. And nobody in their right mind would want to go to war under any circumstances. But in those circumstances, it was a particularly bad prospect. And yet I didn't feel like I could go to Canada or something like that. So I went down, joined the National Guard. About a week later, I got my induction notice. It was that close. So I would have been drafted.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I was, I was very, very lucky. So, and then what happened was I was still working on the ambulance. I had graduated in May of 70. My future wife, Barbara, was in graduate school in Chicago. We couldn't get married. I didn't know when they were going to send me away for basic training. So I had to just keep working on the ambulance, which I did till January of the next year. And then went to Fort Jackson, did my basic and advanced training, and then came home. But it was a crazy time, almost as crazy as now.
Well, you know, you wrote this memoir from the vantage point of 50 years, you know, ahead, or 50 years in the future. So, you know, I guess tell me a little bit about your process. I guess, how long did the book project gestate? Did you think about always wanting to write a memoir about your time on an ambulance? Or what, I guess, how'd you get there?
I did always want to write about it, and I tried it many, many times. And to be quite honest with you, it was horrible. Because a lot of what happened was I was writing, it became kind of a seesaw between now versus then. It was like, well, you know, then we could only do this, and now they have this. And once we had a case, and it was, to me, it was boring, and I did it. So I thought, well, if it's boring to me, it's going to be boring to somebody else. So one night I saw a movie called Wings of Desire, which is a German movie with Peter Falk in it. It was a play within a play, and all kinds of stuff. And I don't know what happened, but it freed up my thinking. And I thought, well, you know, I can write this any way I want. And I decided to write it as a first-person narration, as if I were going through every call, or as if I was back with a friend in the dormitory and I was telling him about my summer that I had had, or even some of the conversations that were going on in my head. A lot of what's in the book were the thoughts I was actually thinking at the time. The more I went through each call, the more I remembered. It was pretty astonishing. I started remembering people's names that I had forgotten. But I had the list of stories down many, many years ago that I wanted to talk about. I just couldn't figure out a way to tell it. When I finally, 2 years ago, figured out how to tell it, it only took 4 months to write, and the stories just kind of wrote themselves. So they are very short, because when you think about the way we worked, we only went into people's lives for 15 or 20 minutes at a time. I mean, we were in and out, grabbed them and took off. So it just seemed to really work very well then. And fortunately, I have a very good longtime friend, James Patterson. I had been looking around for an agent like crazy, and that's very, if you've ever tried to do that, that's quite daunting. And I had gotten in touch with him just to see if he could recommend an agent. And his assistant said, well, he wants to read a couple of chapters, and he did. And he said, oh, they're okay, but I don't know how I can help you. Let me know. And about a week later, I said, well, if you like it and you want to write a blurb, that would be great. So I finished the book. Oh, he said yes, and I finished the book. And about a year later, I was sitting around the house. He said, well, you know, I should send this book to him just so I have a blurb in the can if he cares to write one. But he liked it very much, and he said he could get it to an editor at Little Brown if I would like that. And, of course, I did. You know, I loved it. And it all happened pretty quickly after that.
Wow. Well, that's a great story, because I see the blurb by James Patterson, but I had no idea how it came across his desk.
It's very funny. He was actually at Vanderbilt in graduate school the year I was a senior.
Oh, wow.
And we were both English majors. I think I may have run into him at a, this is very archaic, at an English department sherry party. I have to ask him if that was him, but I think it may have been. But it's funny. His work ethic, when we were both at an agency, J. Walter Thompson in New York, and he would come in hours before anybody else and write.
Oh, wow.
His work ethic is just unbelievable.
That's good material for your next memoir, for sure. Well, Mike Scardino, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Congratulations on the new book. It's called Bad Call, A Summer Job on a New York Ambulance. And it's a new memoir by my guest today, Mike Scardino. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our shows, you can stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Rigsby at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.